Well, welcome everyone. This is Faded Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels. I read romance novels.
And I'm Jen Prokop, and I read and review romance novels.
This is, what is this, book five? Have we already done five whole books?
I know. It's going by really fast.
It is. This is book five. This is Dark Desires After Dusk. The demons are with us. Demons! I'm so excited.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Well, and not only do we get demons, which is pretty exciting, but Holly is the first, like, human, like, real human character.
Yeah.
And so she's also, I mean, she, it turns out, is a Valkyrie, but she doesn't know that, and he doesn't either at the beginning.
Surprise!
Yeah, so I think there's some interesting things going on there.
You know, it's interesting because I think the human heroine is a thing that you see over and over and over again in other paranormal series. And you never, I mean, aside from Holly, you don't see anybody who sort of really thinks of themselves as a human, except for Lothair.
Well, and Chloe.
Oh, I guess Chloe. Oh, so you do. I take it all back. She does a few of them, but she doesn't do as many as the other series tend to do. And that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, and they're all different.
They all have, yeah, very different identities and very different pathways to immortality and revelations as they go. So when we get to another one, we'll have someone to compare them to now that we've done Holly. And so I'm just going to do a quick overview as per usual. This is Cadeon Woeid. Is this what we've decided?
Well, this is what Robert Petcoff has decided. That's okay. If you heard him say it, you'd be like, oh, okay then.
I always in my head pronounce it Woeid, but apparently I know that Robert and Cressley have a relationship of a sort, and I'm sure that she and he have discussed this, and it's Woeid. So we're gonna go with that. So Cadeon Woeid is the prince of a demonarchy, the Rage Demonarchy. And
Rothgalina,
his brother is a deposed king, or a dethroned king. I was going to say defrocked. That's a different thing entirely.
Different thing. Usurped.
Yes. So, and Cade has a lot of guilt. Cade, a million years ago, his brother was, dethroned. And it's because of Cade, through a confluence of happenings. He was not there to protect the throne when he should have been. And instead, now it's in the hands of an evil sorcerer, right?
Well, or a cute dancing tree. No, I'm kidding. Oh, no.
wait, Groot is the metallurgist, right?
Yeah, no. Groot is Omort's brother. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a... Okay, so there's Omort... and he is the evil sorcerer who currently is living the life as king of Rothgalina. But basically all the demons who live in this world are subject to him. And they're living in a horrible way. And basically the entirety of this book and the next book that we will read in the series, which is, oh my God, what's his name? Sabine and Rydstrom. Everything between Cade and Rydstrom's books is about returning Rothgalina to its rightful monarch, who is Rydstrom. And it gets weird. But Cade, here's the thing. Last book, that when we did Naomi and Conrad's book, Cade and Rydstrom were both secondary characters in that book. They were also secondary characters in Mariketa and Bowen's book. They were working to get Thrain's key in the Talisman High, because obviously they have a reason why they'd like to go back in time and fix some things too. They lost. They were trapped in the cave with the incubi with Mariketa, and they became kind of really lovely additional band of brothers in those books. And then they move forward into Naomi and Conrad's book, and they become a sort of they're hunting Conrad through that book because Conrad has drunk the memories of someone who knows how to depose this evil guy and get him off the throne so that Radstrom can take his rightful throne. That doesn't work out either, as we know, because we've seen Conrad and Naomi live happily ever after. And now we are in a place where Nyx has said to Cade, she says it to him at the very end of the last book. She offers him a choice. She says, you can have your fated mate or you can return your brother to the throne. And he chooses to return Radstrom to the throne.
Well, and it's both of them, right? I mean, they're both sitting there and it's kind of like, do the two of you want your fated mates or the throne?
Well, she doesn't say that to Radstrom.
I think they're both there.
They are both there. But yeah. This is my problem with Radstrom. Like leading in, I think this is the first of Cressley's like villainous, I think for me, and we'll get there in a few weeks. But for me, Radstrom is really the first of Cressley's like villainous heroes in that I think he makes choices that are not nice. They're unkind choices. Like his brother is faced with the opportunity. First of all, it's important to note that Cade at that point knows who his fated mate is. He's met her. Like it's not like, oh, you'll just never have love. It's you literally know that she exists. You know where to find her. And you have to give her up in order to give your brother his kingdom. And he does because he's sort of racked with guilt. But what ends up happening is she's not just a human math professor who is his fated mate. She is also the vessel, which we're going to get to, you guys. It's big.
I have a lot of
feelings. I'm looking at Jen's face right now.
I have a lot of fucking feelings about this vessel business.
She's also the vessel, which means I'm realizing that the descriptions, the overviews of these books are going to get more and more complicated as we move forward in the series. But which means, as we know, there's an accession happening, which is a war between good and evil in the lore. And for the last 8 accessions, so every accession, a child is born and it is either pure good or pure evil. And it's a warrior. So essentially it's like, if you've got this kid on your side, then you're going to win the accession. And for the last, there in the last 8 accessions, 7 have been
bad,
pure evil.
Yeah, and Omort is one of them. He's a child of one of the vessels. And so that was like a little interesting tidbit, I thought, right? We know how bad he is because he was the big power player in a previous accession.
Exactly. So this is one of those scenarios where we're gonna get to it, but I really think, I said this to Jen earlier this week, I think this book is basically Romancing the Stone. And Holly, our heroine, who doesn't know anything about the lore, she is human at the start of this. She literally is human at the start of this. She doesn't know that she is the vessel, but she is identified as the vessel. And suddenly all hell breaks loose because everyone is trying to get to her. She's basically like the jewel of the Nile, right? Like she...
the uterus of the Nile.
Yeah. And they're all trying to get to her to either kill... There are factions who want to kill her because if she's dead, she can't birth this warrior, be it good or evil. There are factions of the good who want to get to her and protect her and keep her safe for good. And then there are, of course, like lions, the lion's share of characters in the book are bad. And they would like to get her so that they can breed her and basically produce an heir. We meet her she's at the college where she teaches. She is abducted by a battalion of demons and taken to a dungeon where she is presumably about to be
raped.
Yeah. Gang raped by demons.
Yeah. Here's the part where this was kind of an interesting insight I had, and I maybe we're like, it's a lot of plot. Like, I'm ready to talk, but One of the things I found myself thinking is, like, this is the first time we ever get a heroine in mortal danger who doesn't know how to get herself out of it. And I think it's because she's human. I think Cressley's making a comment on the kinds of dangers that human women face.
Yes. And Holly's really lucky, right? Because obviously we should trigger warning the fact that, like, yes, there is a sexual, there is an attempt at sexual assault here. But she gets terrified and instead, and in her, through her fear, she finds rage. And who among us has not been in that moment? And she, in her rage, she summons, I mean, it's sort of inferred that she, or it's implied that she summons Freya, and like she summons the power of the gods, the god and goddess who make Valkyries. She is struck by lightning and her Valkyrie powers appear, and she beheads these 10 demons.
Oh, I mean, she completely rips them to shreds, right?
Which is, and I want to say, like, appreciating your point that here we are, we have our first heroine who, like, doesn't know what to do with herself. She's put in a position of not being able to fight back. And then suddenly she's able to fight back. One, I sort of love that. But we also see, like, this is the first time we really see a heroine, like, take down a whole team of villains with the hero basically nowhere. Like, nowhere to right. be seen. He doesn't right. turn up. Like, he's, of course, terrified, and he's trying to find her, and he doesn't know where she is. And he's, like, racing around like an idiot outside. And she – and he walks in, and she's beheaded. It's carnage. Like, it's Holly freaking out, because who wouldn't freak out at this point? Like, she's just destroyed 10 demons, and she didn't even know demons existed 20 minutes ago.
Well, and I think it's going to be interesting near the end of the podcast for us to the mirror, the like sort of at the end of the book, the book ending scene is one where she saves herself from Groot. Mm-hmm. And the way her her mind is working is totally different. Like in this one, it's almost like she's feral. Like mm-hmm. she defends them, but it's pure instinct. There's no part of Holly that's a part of it. It's just pure like Valkyrie lightning fueled rage. It's almost like she doesn't even know. She doesn't even know really that she's done it. And I think it's really interesting, like through the course of the book, one of the things we see is her like Holly kind of joining with this Valkyrie self and becoming immortal, but like kind of retaining her, she has a PhD in math, or is like, you know, basically, you know, one, you know, some bullshitty one thing away or whatever. But, you know, I was like really fascinated by her evolution. Her evolution isn't just to like accepting she's a Valkyrie. It's like, I think her evolution's about, I'm both a Valkyrie and this like whip smart person, and I can be both.
Yes. And that's pretty fabulous, because at the beginning of the book, she doesn't want it. I mean,
oh, right.
Holly sort of, her identity at the start of the book is very much about, it's very much about sort of being an insular, it's fearful. It's a sense of like, she has fear of the unknown. She has fear of losing control, a deep fear of losing control because of her past experiences, where you get the sense, Cressley sort of lays these like really lovely breadcrumbs down where you get the sense that there have been several instances over the course of Holly's life where perhaps she could have embraced her Valkyrie tendencies, but like has resisted it at every turn. All of them sexual, I would add, which is another – this is our first heroine who's a virgin. She's not our first virgin, but she is our first heroine who's, like, sexually repressed in some way.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
She's terrified of her sexual side, because every time she has sexual feelings, like, that sort of Valkyrie instinct comes out, and we know Valkyries, like, love it.
Yeah.
Like, Nyx right. is always running around saying she wants to lick demon horns, right?
Right.
Like, we discover what that all means here in this book.
But like, yes, we do.
So we've talked over and over the last couple of episodes, or I have at least, about how like this is really just like every book in this series is very much about like women and sexuality and like understanding like women as sexual beings and a sexual identity. And in this particular case, like Holly is repressed at the yeah. start of this. Self-repressed.
And I would say, like, shamed, right? Like, she, the, like, especially there's this really painful reminiscence about this teenage boy she, like, scared away with her ardor. And I think, like, that's another thing. It's not ladylike. There's a real, you know, Holly doesn't like people who curse, which I personally felt very judged by. She doesn't like...
Same.
Right? I was like, fuck you, Holly. She, you know, she wears, like, twin sets and pearls. And so, like, I think part of it, too, is, you know, that there's a... She's very much like an archetype for a certain kind of, like, almost like 1950s housewife. Except for the fact that she's also getting a PhD in, you know, combinatorial physics or whatever the fuck it is. So I think that that's part of the thing that's really interesting is her, you know, like, what she's internalized as sort of, like, what womanhood should look like. It's very repressed, and it's based on a lot of, I don't know, I'm really fascinated by it. Like, we talked a lot about Lachlan, sort of, like, what is modernity. I think Holly is the first character, the first female character who I see grappling with, like, a similar set of, I don't know, struggles, maybe.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. I think Holly is... Yeah, I think there's a sense from Holly from the start that there's a resistance to anything that is remotely beyond her control, right? Like, and I think certainly we've seen this heroine before in romance novels, who is kind of really put together. She's like she is very prim. She is very proper, and she literally ultimately, like, lets her hair down and becomes like, and is sort of awoken by sex. What's fascinating here is that through it, you sort of think, oh, this is what Cressley's doing. Holly's going to be wake up when sex happens. That's not what wakes Holly, though. Holly becomes sort of awoken by the lore in general.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, so there's this remarkable scene. I want to talk about the Laughing Lady Bridge.
Oh, for sure, right?
So there's this great, so it's a road, this is a road trip romance. Like, when I say it's Romancing the Stone, it really feels very sort of rollicking to me in that sense. Holly is very much the sort of Joan Wilder character.
Joan Wilder? The Joan Wilder?
And Cade is, like, the perfect Michael Douglas, like, with his, like, you know, just everything about him is, like, wrinkled and irritating. And he's the guy who would, like, hack off the heel of a shoe.
These were Italian.
Now they're practical.
That doesn't happen exactly, but, like, he hates, like, there's a moment where he's like, these shoes are ridiculous in this book, right? So they are on this, they're essentially, like, it's a bit of a MacGuffin. There's a sword that they need to get to, and that sword will, like, the person who owns this sword will kill the man, the villain, the evil villain who holds currently the control to Rothgelina. So Cade and Holly have to road trip to these, like, multiple checkpoints in order to get directions to Groot, who is not an adorable dancing tree, but a metallurgist who has forged this sword that will kill an unkillable being. And basically, the payment for this sword is the vessel. He wants to impregnate the vessel. And so this is the story. We've been here before with many other romances. So Cade and Holly end up at the second checkpoint of this book, which is called the Laughing Lady Bridge. And it has a remarkable story that is...
Oh, I thought it was fascinating.
Really emotional. Like, so the story is basically, like, there was a serial killer in this town, and he would abduct women and take them to this bridge, and then
the thing I thought was especially poignant, though, is these are women who don't have a support system, right? Like, there's something really specific about how isolated they were.
Like Holly.
Yes, like, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, right? It's all a symbol.
Exactly. So he would take these sort of proper, isolated women and bring them to this bridge where he would stab them and then tell them that if they could laugh at their circumstances, he would let them go. And of course, they never could. So he would dump them into this river and they would die. And the spirits of these women are haunting this bridge. And Cade and Holly get into an argument on this bridge, and he thinks she shouldn't go across it. There's like a back and forth. And he, of course, is trying to protect her from this bridge. And he's like pulling her in one direction, and the ghosts attack him. The spirits attack him. And it's confusing. And he's sure that this is some sort of sting operation, that it's a booby trap from the evil side of the lore. And he's telling her to run, telling her to run. And Holly is so brilliant. In the moment, she realizes what's going down, that these ghosts are protecting her. And she's the one who steps in and says, and like saves the day again, but this time not being a Valkyrie. This time she steps in and saves the day as a human,
right? As a mathematician, right?
Brilliant Holly puts it together.
Well, and that's like, I think then like a real turning point for her again, like sort of knowing like when to fight and when to use logic. And there's a whole thing where she's building this, you know, her PhD essentially is complete when she completes this brilliant code. And the code is sort of like it attacks everything and she has to figure out how to get it to only attack when it's an enemy. And it's clearly it's her story, right? Like, and there's a part of me that like really ended up admiring some of that, even though there were lots of things about this book that it was harder for me, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about why.
Let's do it.
I mean, I think part of it really is, okay, so like when you read paranormal, right, you get cut loose from human concerns. And this book with like the vessel was, I just was like furious, right? I was really furious that she's basically an incubator. And part of it is that that's how women are treated in the world. The lore in so many ways is like above human like shittiness, above the patriarchy. And yet here is a way in which it's like codified in a really explicit way. And the other part of being the vessel that also made me furious is the father of the child is what will determine whether or not the child is good or evil. It's like has nothing to do with her, right? Like Holly's inclinations will mean nothing. And that sort of like genetic determinism just like made me really furious. Like you're just literally an incubator. Like you will have nothing to do with how this kid turns out. And I was just like, oh, I hated it. And I hated the fact that she would have no say in it, that it, she, you know what I mean? Like it, like a, so much about that whole plot was just really, It you know, it's like things that make me furious in real life. And so to have it be happening to Holly made me furious for her. And also,
yeah,
you know,
so
like furious reading it. Yeah,
I think I totally see all of that. And I agree with it, except it, and it worked for me because of that, because I felt like, here's the thing. If Holly had been a Valkyrie or a witch or a fairy at the start of the book and 10,000 years old or 1,000 years old, it wouldn't have worked, right?
Right.
Because her vesselhood would have been, they immediately would have sort of, they would have been able to protect themselves, one. They would have known exactly what the repercussions were of it. They would have made choices that would, if she were Valkyrie, like, if she were any of those creatures, she would have been able to make choices that would prevent her from being sort of a pawn in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And the growth over the course of the book, Holly's journey is from pawn to queen, right?
Right.
Or, I mean, princess, I guess, in this scenario. But, and so ultimately, I will say this. The one problem that I had with all of this was that at the very start, Nyx basically shows up. Well, first of all, I just want to qualify that Holly has a very feminist response to this idea of, like, the concept of the vessel. Like, she's like, what the hell is this? This is some bullshit. And Cade names it. Cade says, like, oh, that's a really feminist way of thinking about it. Like, Cressley's having the I always feel like one of the things Cressley does better than anybody is she's keenly aware of how the reader is experiencing the story. And she often like sort of places, she vocalizes the reader's thoughts like in the moment, which she does. One of the things that I have a problem with in this though is Nick's comes because obviously here's a new Valkyrie. She comes over. She's like, hey, I'm your Aunt Nyx. And
right.
And she's like, welcome to being a Valkyrie. I wrote you a letter. And in the letter, but like before she gives her the letter, she says, just FYI, if you don't eat, you can't have a baby.
Yes.
And she gives Holly power in that moment, right? And here's the thing. These books are about birth control. Like every book is about birth control in some way. Like they're all different. Cressley spends so much time building the world so that birth control is coded into it. So these characters never, ever have babies that they aren't choosing to have, which I think is really interesting, right? And Holly gets given she's given an IUD. She's told, like, don't eat and you won't get pregnant.
Right.
And she eats. And every time she eats, I think to myself, why is she eating?
Yeah. Like,
what is the thing that is making her eat? And then at the end, we're told, like, well, she would have gotten pregnant anyway.
And that was part of, I think, what was... Well, I think here's my other problem with it. It's, you know, this is book 5, it's book 18, and this baby has never been heard from again,
sure,
right?
The baby is Thrain's key, right? Like,
yeah, it's just
there
for later.
This baby exists, and at some point, presumably, this baby is going to be important. Maybe not, though. Because, I mean, it would require an aging of, I mean, I guess nobody ages, so...
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't really matter. I think one of the other things, though, that struck me, and you and I've like saved some like screenshots of text where we talk about this. Part of me thinks this is really the first book where there's truly advancement of the accession plot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. In every other book, it's like the accession is coming. We can tell it's happening. The timing is right. But this is really the first time we get movement of like the accession's really happening, that this, you know, like we're birthing the super warrior of the accession. And my ultimate feeling was that, and I think this relates a lot to the conversation we had about like, would this make a good movie or whatever? In our AMA a couple weeks ago, but I feel like there's part of me that thinks Cressley's not actually all that interested in the accession, right? She's interested in these characters like falling in love and like throwing them against each other.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is a book where maybe she figured out that the accession is like needs to be more background than it is. Like it's not actually all that interesting of a plot in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this because I went back and forth on whether we should do this book alone. And
yes,
part of the reason why I felt that way is because I think this book is hard on its own because it is so tied to the book before it and the book after it. So the book that comes after this is Rydstrom's book, which is happening concurrently. So Rydstrom gets abducted at the very beginning of this book, which actually is the inciting – his abduction is the inciting incident for this journey that Holly and Cade take. And then he returns at the end of this book, a changed man. And that, you know, 300 pages of Cade and Holly is about 250 pages of Rydstrom and Sabine. And I feel like what this book is doing is laying all the groundwork for the next book in the series. And this is the first book where I have felt you can't start here.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, or it's almost like I found myself thinking about a lot about like what decisions Cressley makes. And I feel like I had this question where I thought, what if like Bowen's book had come before Catherine's book, right? Like some of these books that are paired together, mm-hmm. like have to happen in a certain order. And I found myself wondering, like, I wonder if Rydstrom's book came first, if Cade's book would have been more interesting. you know, I mean, I'm not saying, like, obviously, you know, there's still so much about this book. I think it's really powerful and amazing, but I think it's the first book that maybe failed to hold up to the promise of a previous book, or that just, I feel like, really needs its companion book for me to see how it's all going to work out.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that this is one of those scenarios where in paranormal, in urban fantasy, in sci-fi, you know, you can't read book three of Game of Thrones and, like, know what the hell's going on, right?
Right.
And I think that's what's happening here. I also think, surely, like, right, prior to this is Cressley, first of all, this is everybody's learning how to write paranormal at this point, right?
Right.
It's Cressley's first crack at paranormal. And I don't know that this is a misstep. I just think we talked earlier today related to something else about, like, how structurally, like, interesting structure in romance is really interesting to me. And I think what's happening here is there is a really interesting structure going on between this book and the next book. And right. And it is one of those things where I feel like on our next podcast, when we do that book, we're going to be hearkening back to this book more and more. I also think that this book is trying to do something a lot more emotional about human females. And, like, I think this is it almost felt to me like Cressley was going through a thing writing this.
Yeah.
Like, this book is about what it is like to be a woman in the world, a human female in the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because that's the thing I was saying. It's like the things that Holly grapples with, right? So it's like, am I in charge of my own body? Am I just, like, a vessel for men to pour themselves into? Her boyfriend is stealing her work.
And Cade is kind of an asshole.
Oh, yeah.
Cade is an asshole to everyone. And there's sort of this sort of lovable rogue. He's like a charming rogue. He is literally the Michael Douglas character in Romancing the Stone. Like, you sort of hate, love him. So, like, he's not even helping her through it. And first that really enraged me. Like, so Holly has takes medication for OCD, which is an interesting, there's a whole interesting thing about OCD in this book. Holly has a compulsion to organize things by in sets of three. She is compulsively clean. She is incredibly controlled all the time. There are a lot of things about her that are that could be coded as obsessive compulsive tendencies. There's a whole side piece, which is, once one becomes immortal, is she then, like, if immortality cures us of all disease, does it cure us of mental illness? Is a question that I think is worth sort of noodling.
Well, and I think, or, like, I was talking to another friend of mine, it's almost like there's some interesting scenes where, like, she recounts or recalls the shrink who diagnosed her, and it was sort of this, you know, she's afraid of losing herself, and that's why she acts the way she does. And, you know, it sort of reads like, again, like, sort of like assuming best intentions or whatever, or like, sort of like intent, it reads very much as these tendencies she has developed are in order to control a body she can tell is wanting to do things that she doesn't understand.
Exactly. Which is in some ways problematic and in some ways interesting. And I don't know where I am on that. I feel like I'm in both camps on that.
Yeah. And you know what? I feel like it's okay for us to be that. I'd be pretty curious to know if someone who has been diagnosed with OCD has read this book and what they would say. And I feel like that would be interesting to hear. But it's not something it made me uncomfortable. I would just say, like, there are times it felt like, should mental illness be, like, a plot device and something you can just, like, slough off with the mortal coil? And I, you know, again, like you, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, and I also think it's interesting because I think Cade's response to it, is instantly sort of, it's not dismissive. It's just sort of like, he doesn't even pay it any attention at all.
Like, it's just not who she is to him.
Negative. It's just not a thing. And what's interesting is at first this really bothered me. Like, there are texts for sure that Jen has with me saying, like, what is with this guy? Like, because in my mind, every other Cressley hero, every hero I've ever written, every great, it's sort of like a covenant of like the hero of a romance novel would like tear through. At one point she says, I need my pills. And he says, we can't go back to your house because there will be vampires there. And in my head, I was like, every single romance hero, immortal or not, would
move heaven and earth to get her medicine.
Destroy a like entire pack of vampires to get his heroine like the pills she needs. Right?
Right. Right.
So, and I couldn't really understand what was happening and why that was happening. But then I sort of realized, like, this entire book is about Cade standing with Holly as she discovers her own power, right?
Yeah.
And so at no point does he sort of help her in that. Like, there's never a scene where he says, like, let me show you what you can do. The only thing he does teach her to fight with a sword, right?
He teaches her to fight. Well, he extensively teaches her not just how to fight with a sword, but how to recognize an attacker, how to evade an attacker, how to think through being in a fight. And it's then clear at the very end that he's a big part of, like, giving her the, like she needs a lot of routine. And it's really interesting to go back and read those scenes because he's essentially teaching her like a, what we say in a classroom is like a thinking routine. Mm-hmm. And it's a thinking routine for what you do when you're in a fight. And at the end of the book, we see her, right? Remember, at the beginning, it was just pure instinct. But we see her at the end with Groot. She really does... She has learned how to do this thing, and it's because he taught her.
Yeah. Well, he returns control to her, right? Her massive fear at the beginning is not that, like, she's the vessel and people are chasing her. Her fear at the beginning is that all of these – that she has beheaded 10, like, living beings, and she has no recollection of doing it and no understanding of why she did it. And so, or how she did it. And Cade, it is one of those moments where I'm sort of realizing now as we talk, like, it is a beautiful partnership. It's just not a typical romance partnership. Like, this is not a hero who is a savior. This is a hero who is a supporter.
And I think it's also because we are very aware the entire time that he thinks he's going to give her up. Right? That he knows that this is what he's going to have to do. And I think there's a lot of, one of the things I did end up really liking was there's a lot of really fascinating kind of meta commentary on the whole idea of fated mates in this.
Yeah.
Right. And so at some point he defines a fated mate for her as, it's like, you're the person who I'm going to be happiest with. Actually, I should probably look up the exact quote. I'll see if I can find it. Because I definitely highlighted it with like 18 other things. And then there's a whole other part that's like really interesting where he's talking to Rock, his friend, right? The smoke demon. I know. And, you know, and Rock's basically like, listen, motherfucker, I have no idea what's going on in your head that would even make you think about choosing her over an entire kingdom full of people. Like, I cannot. I mean, he basically is like, I have no way of understanding what that would even be like. And it's really before the fated mates thing has always been like this push pull between two really strong individuals. Mm-hmm. And this is really the first time we get like the incredible price that you would have to be willing to pay in some circumstances and how he struggles with that, especially because, you know, his primary like way of being in the world is I'm a disappointment. I disappoint people.
Yeah.
Right. I disappoint myself. I disappointed my brother. I disappointed my foster family. And I'm going to disappoint her. It's inevitable. That's my fate. And I ended up really liking this in a lot of ways, felt like this is a real struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because Lachlan, you know, his people aren't going to approve of him marrying a vampire, but he's the king. He doesn't give a shit.
Exactly.
This is really where Cade, you see, like, this is pretty hardcore. And I did end up thinking that was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the challenge always, is this sense of responsibility. I love a hero who has, heavy is the head that wears the crown, right?
Yes.
And what I think, and actually the more, just saying that makes me think, well, maybe we would feel differently if we saw Rydstrom's book first and then Cade's. Because, like, Cade is such a, I mean, like, he's so connected to his responsibilities. Like, he feels deeply responsible for his brother. He feels deeply responsible for the kingdom. But he also feels deeply responsible for Holly.
Yeah.
In that he's in that moment, just to go back to what you were saying, like, in that moment where he realizes he's going to have to give her away ultimately, he's going to have to give her up, teaching her the thought process of fighting, like giving her the skill with swords, like giving her the things that he can give her. It's almost as though what he's saying is, like, I have to give you up, but you're going to be okay without me.
Right.
And
right.
If I do nothing else, what I will ensure is that you'll be okay without me. So maybe he is a savior hero. He's just a savior hero in such, like, a different, fascinating way.
And it is. And it's, I think it's challenging.
I want to talk about when I fell in love with him, though.
Okay.
Because, as you know, at the beginning of the book, I was not in love with him.
Yes.
And so there is a moment. So we've talked before, I think, about the fact that food is my love language and I like it when vampires feed each other. Or when women feed vampires, or when Lachlan feeds Emma.
Right.
So Holly has a situation where she can only eat prepackaged foods. And she, so she eats like granola bars and like orange juice and like things that are in containers that are packaged,
right.
Because they have purity inside. Cade takes her out for dinner one night and she's basically like, I don't even know why we're at this restaurant because, like, what am I going to eat? I can't eat any of this stuff. And he orders her a lobster.
I know. I know.
Because it's the ultimate.
It's in a shell.
Food. Yeah. So she can eat it herself and nobody has touched the inside. And I was like,
I know.
I love him so much. And I said to my husband, this is the sexiest thing. I just read the most sexy thing in the world in this Cressley book. And he went, don't tell me. I want to hear about it on the podcast. And I'm sure he thinks it's going to have something to do with, like, sexy horn play. And instead, he bought her a lobster.
Well, it is really sweet. It really was. Yeah. Or even, I mean, there's, like, a scene where she, like, tries to open a bottle of water, but she, like, touches it in a way that means she can't drink it. And he just gives her another one. I mean, and sort of is like, yeah, these short caps must make it harder. And I, you know, I did remember thinking, like, that was pretty great that he just, this is just who she was and he loved her. And that part was really, you know, he accepted her a lot more readily, I think, than she accepted him. And I think that was also an interesting journey, right?
Yeah. She's very not into horns.
Too bad.
Wait, can we also talk? Okay, first of all, I love horns. We've done this already.
Yeah.
If you listen to the Ask Me Anything, you know that I love horns. I'm on the record for loving horns. Can we talk about the fact that at the end he cuts them off?
I know.
And
I know.
Then we have, so this is going to come back later in the series, but it's an interesting thing because clearly they grow back on his head.
Well, and it's really interesting because I don't know if you remember this. The first time he sees Holly, which I think is brilliantly handled in a lot of ways, he recounts that he was on a job where a demon family had a son who was going to try and essentially pass and had been, like, cutting off his horns and like, they were, like, so embarrassed that their demon son was essentially trying to pretend not to be a demon. And so I think that's some powerful, like, foreshadowing. The other thing that's great about this is later in the book, we get a chapter where Rydstrom recounts what Cade was like when he first met Holly. And it's this amazing scene where you really get just, you know, he's so like you said, like he's got that Michael Douglas, I'm so cool.
He's just got swagger.
But then you get like Rydstrom describing how just like kind of like a just a schoolboy he was.
And then Holly says too, like you couldn't put a sentence together.
Yeah.
And he kept, poor Cade.
I know.
But it's interesting. What I love is, so over the course of the whole book, Holly's basically, so at first she's like, ugh, horns. And then Nyx comes in and says, oh, you should touch them. Yeah. I love Nyx. She's so awesome.
There's a lot of great Nyx in this book, actually. Tons.
She's like, you should totally touch them. You should touch them. Why don't you touch them? And then Holly's like, oh, no, thank you. I don't think I will. And then, like, it becomes clear that there are sexual organs for him. And then and then you get to the point where she's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to touch him.
Oh, yeah, and right. That's when he can't resist her anymore.
Get it, girl. And then.
Well, remember, though, the first horns she touches in the book are Desh's. Remember?
Yeah,
we get Deshnazor. And that's when. Like, she sort of, like, grabs them, and that's when Cade's like, it's, like, basically, like, she reached out and cupped his balls. Right?
And he's so horrified and so
but jealous.
He's jealous, but, like, he refuses to, like, make it a thing.
Well, because he had just been with Amatra making out in the back room or whatever.
I know, and she was slowing time, so.
Yes.
And then, but the whole time, Holly has this sort of, like, visceral... Again, it's that sort of fear of horns, and then like interest in horns, and then like a lot of interest in horns. And then he cuts them off, and she's like, what the hell did you do to your horns?
Yeah. Bring them back.
And it's sort of this wonderful moment where you see like she's fully immersed in the lore. And like,
right, and she accepts
she's
him.
She's never
right.
going back. She doesn't want to be a mathematician like at a research institution anymore. Like,
right.
She's going to be a Valkyrie. She's going to be the vessel. She ends up pregnant. She's the first character in the series that we see pregnant.
Right. I want to go back though before you like skipped all the good sex stuff. And
no,
I feel
let's
like.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back to pregnancy.
Well, I could like, let's not. Not my favorite part of my life.
I loved being pregnant, for the record. Most people don't say that, but I really did.
Yeah, that was not really my jam at all.
Interestingly, this is sort of relevant. Apparently, so when you're pregnant, you have like 50% more blood in your body than you do when you're not pregnant, which makes sense. And I remember being like 8.5 months pregnant and seeing my doctor and saying like, I feel great. Like, I don't feel tired. And her saying, yeah, you're somebody who likes the blood. Some women just really like the extra blood.
Interesting.
And now here we are. It was fated that we were going to do
this. Anyone who listens to this and is like, I'm a miserable pregnant person, you can message me and I will hold your hand because it's also nice to have people like that, you know?
Yeah. No, for sure. Pregnancy is weird.
So, yeah. Okay. Like, let's enough
with
that.
But I like some extra blood. So...
You know, my son was born 5 weeks early, so I also, like, never even got to that point. It was just over.
Well, you probably would have been tired.
Yeah. I was already tired. Exactly. I think I willed him out. I definitely have some superpowers. I was like, I'm over it. Okay, so let's talk about the sex thing, because I do think it's really interesting the way that evolves, and I was pretty unsure. Because she's so repressed, right? I was like, how is this going to work out? And one of the things that I thought was really fascinating is there's a couple scenes where it's almost like Holly is going through like what I was thinking of as like Valkyrie puberty. Like she literally wakes up one night and it's like a wet dream, right? Like she's waking up and having, and I just thought that was like really interesting too, that like her sexual awakening is not just because of things she's doing with Cade. It's also like her figuring out her own body. And I liked that a lot.
Which is awesome. Like,
yeah, it was awesome.
Awesome.
It really was.
That whole thing. And I will say, we see that happen again. Chloe has that happen. Anytime there's an immortal who hasn't completed their journey to immortality, they're into sex.
And I thought it was like, I don't know, like clever, like for lack of a better word. I was like, oh, I see what she's doing here. I like it.
No, I mean, I love it. I loved
Yeah.
And I also loved like his whole, what was really fascinating is the sort of how Cade's fear of attempting her. That's how demons refer.
Oh, I want to talk about that in a minute. Go ahead and say your thing.
You want to talk about attempting?
Yeah, because this was the book where I was like, oh, attempting is bullshit. Like, this is just like the lie, like the lie of the demons. I got to attempt all these women and find out which one is my one, because Cade knows that she is his before he ever has sex with her. Right?
Yeah.
He knows that. And so he doesn't need to attempt jack shit. He knows it. And so it's really interesting the way in so many other books, it's like, oh yeah, these demons just like fuck like rabbits until they find the one they can ejaculate with.
Attempts like everyone and their mother.
Right. And that's when I was like, oh, this just seems like a pretext for, you know, like, right. Because then they're not like the nymphs, right? Then it's like, it's an important task. I'm out there attempting.
Yes.
Right? And I just thought that was really interesting.
And actually, it's interesting because I did mark this in my copy of the book, that there's a moment where he says, I sort of love, he takes her computer for something and he like he's like Googling things and then he's like, I'm going to look at her search history, which is a violation, but whatever, I'll allow it for this moment. He's like, I'm going to look at her search history, and he finds nothing. And then he finds that on Google, she has the safe content filter on.
Yes, I know.
And he leaned back in his chair trying to imagine a life filtered of anything sexual, not worth living. And then
I know, it's so funny.
He hasn't been with another woman since the day he met Holly, which is the longest stretch of celibacy, obviously, since he first had sex, because he's a demon. And then he references that he'd given a half-hearted try for a witch earlier, a few months earlier. So that's clearly Mariketa. During the Talisman High. So, we always sort of get really deep on Cressley and these books and like what they mean and the sort of the important emotional and social components, but it is important for us to remember that Cressley is hilarious.
Oh, for sure.
These
right?
books like, are for sure. incredibly funny, and we never really give it enough attention. Also, we also, on my list, we also have to talk about Rock, who you already brought up.
Oh, yeah.
So we talked in the Ask Me Anything about how I would really like to see Rock get his own book, because he's a smoke demon, and smoke demons have, whenever they have sex with a female, they have to make an arrangement, and they sign a contract basically allowing her to summon them at any point for a predetermined length of time, and I think that's hilarious, but I particularly like that Rock refers to them as swimbos,
right?
Because instead of it being a derogatory term like bimbo, it means she who must be obeyed. And I think that's delightful. It's another example of Cressley just being hilariously.
Oh, like, it was so funny.
Funny and turning everything on its head.
Agreed. Well, and I think, well, and here's the thing, though, like, the thing I really appreciated about, back to like the sex, and like once it gets going, it's pretty hot. Sarah, get back on track. you know what I love though? So she is so in charge of it, because he does not even really want to have sex with her, because he knows ultimately he might betray her. And he is very aware of the fact that if he must betray her, then sleeping with her will really have been this like ultimate betray, like, right, the ultimate betrayal. Like, I knew I was going to do this and I slept with you anyway. But it's Nyx essentially who's like, it's not up to him, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that moment where I sort of forgave the vessel business,
mm-hmm.
because it was so clear that she was going to be absolutely in charge of whether or not, mm-hmm. right, like, this is my decision. And there's even a part where she thinks about, like, I have money, I could take care of a baby. Like, she's deciding.
Mm-hmm.
She gets to decide everything. And she's the one who really initiates it and says, like, we're going to do it. And he's like, and then she grabs his horns and it's literally, like, yep. game over.
Because Valkyrie's going to Valkyrie, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I do, while we're still talking about Nyx and her, you know, this is one of the first times in the whole series where we really see Nyx like dig in and like fuss with the plot. Like,
yes.
She comes in multiple times to like put everything back on track, which I think is great because it establishes her character early in the series as like someone who can, oh, at any point she can toddle in and like fix a problem or like make something harder. But Cade comes to her at one point and says, like, I don't understand. She's a Valkyrie. You're the, you know, proto Valkyrie. Oh, I want to pause for a second and just acknowledge that somebody commented on our podcast that Fury is not the primordial Valkyrie. Fury is a Fury.
Nyx is.
Nyx is the primordial Valkyrie. So thank you for commenting. We acknowledge that we were wrong on an earlier episode.
We definitely welcome you correcting us,
sure,
if we get the details wrong.
Sure, slide in and correct us. It's totally fine. But Nyx, you know, Nyx is there, the primordial Valkyrie, her aunt. Like, she's supposed to be protecting her. And Cade is sort of like, what's your deal, Nyx, because you're supposed to be protecting her? And there's a little part of him that's, like, irritated in that moment. Like, why aren't you protecting her? And she says, and this is, I want to like tattoo this on my body.
It was amazing.
She says, there comes a time in a woman's life when innocence is merely a euphemism for ignorance. And I love it. I feel like that's the sort of driving force of this whole series is like moving into knowledge.
And especially for Holly.
Not just for women.
Right, absolutely. And I ended up feeling that was like it makes sense for that information to be about Holly, who in one part of her life is so amazingly intelligent, right? And in another way, she isn't. And it also felt to me about like balance, right? Like she can't be her best self if she's like repressing this big part of who she is. Mm-hmm. And getting that sort of all in balance is what's going to make her like her, you know, the best Holly Ashwin that's entirely possible out there in the world.
Sure. And once Holly knows about stuff, she wants to know more. Like, she doesn't want knowledge in half measures.
Right.
Like, if you gave Holly access to Marichetta's mirror, forget it.
Oh, yeah.
She'd never come back.
You're right. So I do think that part, that to me was really interesting. But also that Cade, like, loved that about her, right? That he, like at one point she sees that he's like Googling things about her field so that he could like talk to her. Oh, and this reminds me of the reason. Wait, I have to remind you of the reason that I went to the Latin emergency. Right. So there's this part that's really funny where he is teaching her to sword fight. And he tells her that essentially like the word sword, right, is essentially means like penis. Like, right. It's, you know, and that it's gladius. The Latin word for sword also means penis. And she's like, it does not. And then he continues on and says that the word scabbard is the Latin word for vagina, right? And I was like, first of all, I was like, okay, this is sort of
this cute. Is a Latin emergency.
It was a Latin emergency. I was like, I also think though, he's like trying to show her I'm smart too.
Yeah.
Right? Like it was cute.
Is it true?
Sort of,
did your friend confirm?
Okay, here's what I found out.
Tell
Sarah.
Me.
The Latin word for penis is actually penis.
Oh,
the word
sure.
Gladius is more like cock, right? Like she's in like we're in like a classroom and she's like whispering to me. I was like, okay. And she's reading it and cracking up. But scabbard really is the Latin word,
for,
word vagina.
For vagina. Wait, what is vagina then?
I don't know. I didn't ask her that.
Wait, can she come on?
Oh, absolutely. She would come on. She's been reading all the books and she's like, I didn't think I could love Cressley more.
Would you please have her take good Latin notes and then she can come on one time? I would love that.
Yeah. But it was really interesting because...
But vagina does sound like it's Latin. My dad was Italian. I speak Italian. Vagina is the same word. So
either way, though, I was sort of like, is he just like bullshitting her? But I did think that he was sort of like showing off for her, like, I'm smart too.
Yeah. So cute.
I thought it was really charming.
So
I was
cute.
Like, is he seducing her with like Latin?
Okay. Oh, can we also say, like, for those of you who are car people, this book is a big car book.
It's like car porn.
It really is. Well, there's literally car porn in it where Cade teaches Holly how to drive a Bugatti Veyron, and it gets faster and faster, and it's like 210 miles an hour. Now, remember, Valkyries really like fast cars, really yes. like fast cars. And at the time, like when she hits 200 miles an hour, she starts to get horny.
Oh, yeah. And then they,
and he can smell it.
They pull over.
Yeah. It's
and
hot.
They basically have like sex on the top of the car.
Well, because he's like, get out of this car. I need to get on you.
Not sword and scabbard sex, but
other things they, in like, scabbard. Right?
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. Right.
But I will say, I would like to also point out that we had an entire conversation. So there's a reference in this car to a Mercedes McLaren.
Yes.
And I do not know about cars, but I do know a lot about Top Gear because the Stig read one of my romance novels in Russian on a Moscow subway. On an episode of Top Gear. You can see it on my website. Jen will link to it on show notes.
Hell yes, I will.
So I have watched a whole lot of Top Gear, and they love fast cars. And a McLaren is an English car. I know this. And I said to Eric, I was like, is McLaren owned by Mercedes? Like, I don't understand. I thought it was a British company. And he was like, no, it's a British company. So we did some research. In fact, the Mercedes McLaren was like a 1-year partnership. Where they made this one car, and it's like a sedan. Like, if a McLaren were going to be in a sedan, it would be this. It's still a cool-looking sedan, but it's, like, sedan-y. And Eric showed it to me and was like, it's not really a gorgeous McLaren. It's not a sports car McLaren. And I looked at it, and it has a higher profile. And I said, well, he's a demon, so he would have to fit. Like, this is the only McLaren he could fit in. And Eric looked at me like I had 23 heads. Like, because I said it as though we were talking about, like, our
real
friend
people.
Bill,
who is just an NBA player.
Like, he's just too tall. He would never fit in a smaller one. He needs a sedan.
That is amazing.
So here we are at my house. We're all down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. It really is. Okay, wait. I'm sorry, because I feel like at the end, there's all the things I wrote down that I'm like, I have to talk about it. Groot, the metallurgist.
Not
the audio.
The small dancing tree.
Not the small dancing tree. Groot, the metallurgist. On the audio, it's like actually an amazing voice. So if you've listened to the audio, you'll know what I'm talking about. But the one part about this book that I felt like was extra and really I did not need was the fact that he had cameras all through their little love cabin.
Yes.
And had been watching them bone for a solid 2 weeks.
Gross.
And I was like, ugh.
He was super gross. And he resurrected women into like zombie bodies. He was gross. Like, this might be the grossest.
Yes. He was super gross.
Dorota, who comes through on Lothair, is not as, she's like physically gross, but she's not like gross gross. He's like a gross person. I mean, we're about to go into Torture Island, so I guess I shouldn't really judge.
Yeah. But I mean, I think thematically that profile of him fits, considering that she's the
sure.
vessel and right
and
like
the sexual
like,
assaults.
Yes. I mean, so in that sense it kind of, you know, symbolically fits in with like what's threatening to
mm-hmm.
her. But he was super nasty, and I was really, really happy when he kicked it. I also thought it was really interesting. I spent a lot of mental time thinking about the fact that Groot is Groot and Omart is Omort. And so there was just like the G and the M. It was just like otherwise their names were the same and just in a different order. And did that mean something? I decided it didn't.
Maybe
and that
not. I don't know.
Had spent too much time thinking about
it. Wow, you're
but,
a nerd.
You know, previously
I mean,
established.
Kel Surprise.
I was like, previously established on every single fucking one of these episodes, Sarah.
Latin emergency.
like, literally, I was like, oh, shit, I have to find this out.
We really are starting to see, like, the scope of Cressley's brain, too, here. Like, with the Wendigos, which arrive. So, like, they're like, skin creatures. Like, mm-hmm. suddenly things get real gross at the end
oh,
of this
yeah.
book. And it's like she's establishing all the baddies, which of course she is, because we need, like, again, it goes back to what Jen was saying about the accession being, this is the accession being really present in this book in a way that it isn't in a lot of them.
Right. I think the thing that amazed me about this book and about all of them is not just how well Cressley handles like the big moments, mm-hmm. but how delightful the little ones are. And I'll give you an example where I literally was like, oh, like I just loved it. So one of the things that Holly's eyesight improves, oh, right? Yeah. Like she essentially, her eyesight.
Her eyes are healed.
Are healed, right? They're perfect. Ugh. Because she no That'd longer, she's right. She's not.
Sign me like, up for Valkyrie hood.
Valkyrie LASIK coming soon. Here's the part that's so great though. When Cade then appears to have betrayed her, what Groot says to her is, you didn't see this coming, not even a little bit. And I thought, oh, like, it's this, like, her vision is fixed, but not her, like, right, like that. I don't know, like, it was like, you didn't see this coming. And I just thought it was, like, this really, like, moment where it just felt so, like, like she'd done something really delicious, and I'm not even sure what to call it, right?
I love you that healed. About you. Because that is peak English teacher. You know that oh, Venn diagram sure. where it's like what English what the author means, what yes. your English teacher says the author means. I think Cressley's amazing. I'm gonna go ahead and say there's a 90% chance she didn't know she was doing that.
I don't care.
But I love
and
it.
You know what? That's fine. I don't care. I teach amazing lessons to kids about how to recognize symbolism. Mm-hmm. And what I tell them is, I was like, it's when your spider sense is tingling. Like, if you feel that it's there,
sure.
like well, it the book, is, right?
Look, I say all the time that books aren't books until they're in the hands of the reader.
Like, right.
They're just not. And a book to you is not the same as that exact same book is not the same to me. Like, it is not the same book. And so I love that. I want to do our limb count. So let's do it.
Well, in this book,
we're only talking about Cade and Holly. Right?
Yes.
We're not doing all these other people who lose everything.
I think on the show notes, I'll keep the running total.
Okay, because there were a lot that I did not
There's
mark.
A lot. It's yeah. too much.
Okay.
But I feel like just per book, I just want to tell you what happened.
Yep.
Cade lost both of his hands,
yep.
part of his face and yes. hair, and an eye.
And an eye, yes.
And I was like, God damn, these motherfuckers. Well,
because who else lost an eye? Conrad?
No, it was when
it's Adriana on the website, you guys. There's a lost link.
Bowen lost an eye. I think there's also this really funny part where Holly describes him like holding up his regenerated
yes,
fingers.
This like wizened, look, Mom, shiny two fingers. Because he's trying to drink.
Yes.
He's trying to like drink from demon brew, and she's like, "No!" And he's like, "I have these fingers. I can do." Oh my god, Cressley!
Oh my god! I was like, "Oh shit! Here we are." I mean, I'm at the point now where if I get to a book and somebody doesn't lose a limb, I'm gonna be like, ugh, disappointed.
What kind of book is this?
This is bullshit.
Okay, yes, I have both hands, face, hair, eye, and I have horns too.
Oh yeah, self-inflicted.
Self-inflicted.
Conrad Roth chops off his fucking hands.
And those counted. We counted those in the limb count.
We counted them.
So there will be, so that is the limb count. I have the same limb count. So that is confirmed. That's fact verified here on Faded Mates. And Jen will add them to, we will have the updated, fully counted limb count on show notes.
Can I tell you the one thing? Here's what the thing that would have made this book more perfect for me, and you're like not going to be surprised, he really did not do enough groveling at the end.
I get that.
On the other hand, I did love that she evaded him for days and like, weeks.
Nope. Like, nope, she you're fired.
She didn't even think he was coming. She's like, I guess I'm on this now. And I did love that. But then at the end, he like buys her a house and she's just like, oh, I'm pregnant. Like, it's going to be the three of us. Ha ha.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I need you to.
A house is not enough, Cade.
No,
not
he
enough.
More.
Here's the thing that I would like readers or listeners and readers to come to us with. So there's a moment after they have a giant orgasm on a Bugatti Veyron. Where Cade says, should we just do this every 500 miles or so? And Holly says, 420.
And I texted Sarah and I was like, is this like a marijuana joke?
And which maybe, And then I was like, well, it is a multiple of three, and Holly had its multiples of three issues, but like, so is 360, so is, you know, 9 miles.
Right.
So like, if anybody, if we missed something and it's not clear, because then 420 comes back a couple of times. It's referenced then like multiple times.
I don't know if I said this to you in text. I was like, maybe it's because like all this sex is like the gateway drug for her. I don't know.
I think to this them, might like, be. I have not like yet rabbits. Used my phone a friend with Cressley yet. And I feel like, because she did say that she would answer some questions if we had them by email. I might email her and be like, what's the deal on the 420 joke? Like,
I know.
What is that?
Well, and maybe it's just because I like hang out with teenagers. And I was literally like, is there a fucking pot joke in here? Unexpected. Like, sex jokes, great. I'm down with that. But I was like, really?
So hit us up on Twitter at Faded Mates, or on Instagram. We're on Instagram now, at Faded Mates Pod on Instagram. If you have any inkling as to what that 420 means outside of it's a pot joke.
If you know Latin.
If you if you know Latin. Or if you know about cars.
Cars. There's a lot. There's a lot left to write for us to dig into. On
also
this one.
Tell us, like, how do you feel about horns?
Yes. We know Kate Claiborne. No. Kate's a no.
Kate's a no. And what's really fascinating to me is that I feel like Kate and Holly, you know, I feel like Kate and Holly have some like an affinity for each other. They're both brilliant. They both don't like horns. But like, Kate never comes to the end of the story with she never comes around on horns, although she hasn't read Wicked Abyss yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, so here's my other thing, though. So my best friend, Kelly, who made our logo, is a big podcast listener, and she thinks that we should have some like games. Right. And I was like, maybe every time we have a guest, we should have like a series of questions. And like horns or claws. Right.
Yeah. Are you horny?
Yes, everyone is.
Okay. All right. I think that's it for today.
I do too. What's our next book is Kiss of a Demon King.
Oh yeah. Now, okay. The titles are changing up now.
Yes, they are.
So this is the last of the like what the hell book are we reading next? titles.
The Dark Desires Needs Dusk Edge. Right. Yeah.
Next book, Kiss of the Demon King, which is interesting because what that tells me as a reader and as a writer is that at this point, it's book six in the series. Readers in 2008 were into this series because Kiss of the Demon King, when they announced that title, for sure, readers were like, oh my God, it's Rydstrom's book. Like, they knew exactly who it was and what was coming. Rydstrom, King of Rothgalina. We've seen him twice in this book. We've seen him evolve from like bold, brave, strong king to something very different and dark.
Yeah.
And his heroine, who is a incredibly powerful sorceress.
I'll also say, and maybe I've said this already, and Eric can cut it if I have, when we ask people to be guests and which book they'd want to be, pretty much everybody says Sabine. Sabine. Like, they that's talk always about the answer.
That's because Sabine is awesome. And we are gonna talk a lot about heroines next week. So join us. Or in 2 weeks. And next week, there's an interstitial coming. We hope you love it. We hope you'll join us. And stick with us, everyone. We are 5 books in and there are no signs of the end is not in sight.
I actually did a little bit of plotting out, and you're stuck with us for a really long time.
We hope you like us in your ear holes. So I already gave you the Twitter and Instagram accounts. You can find Jen at Jen Reads Romance. You can find me at Sarah McLean. You can find all of Jen's genius, brilliant, comprehensive show notes at fadedmates.net. And you can find us on your favorite podcasting platform next week.
Yeah, and you know what? If you're in Chicago or Chicago adjacent or interested, you can also see us both at Avon KissCon. I'll just be attending. Sarah is like a headliner. That's happening in Chicago in early April. And
we'll have some news about meetups, etc. In Chicago. And you know, hit us up. We're friendly. We like to talk about demons.
Anything. Like, just find me.
It was great. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks so much, Jen.
Thanks, Sarah.
All right. Well, do you hear that? Can you hear that?
Oh, the flights. Yeah.
Is it
picking up though? Like, I guess the question is do you see like a?
I don't know. But it doesn't, I mean, like, whatever.
What
it's
are you
a storm.
Do?
I'm on, yeah. I live on the LaGuardia approach, you guys. It's super glamorous. I get a ton, and it's going to go by. I mean, there will be a plane every like 2 minutes from now until the end of time.
until the storm strikes.
I actually don't usually live on the LaGuardia approach. I only live on the LaGuardia approach. When the U.S. Open is happening and they reroute the planes for tennis, or when there's a storm and I guess it's wind. Like, I don't know anything about. I mean, I know that planes are very safe, but other than that, I don't really know how planes take off and land. Although I once saw that United commercial where they have to take off into the wind. So I just assume the reverse is true.
It's a little crazy. Yes.
In the opposite way.